All right, welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I don't know, we should, with a very big sarcastic smile, we should, or grimace, we should label the show the Land of the Free Edition. And it's exactly what we're going to be hitting at through the entire show. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Angad Bala to talk about his film, Herman's House, A Powerful Indictment of Solitary Confinement, and a really beautiful story about two friends standing up against it and asserting their humanity against the greatest of odds. It's the story of Herman Wallace, the man who's been in solitary confinement longer than any other person in this country and perhaps any other human on the face of the earth, and a young woman artist, Jackie Sumel, who's actually, it's just a very powerful film. So we'll be talking with the director of that film. Before that, we'll be talking with Carl Dix. Carl's from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the RCP, the Revolutionary Communist Party. And we'll be talking about a proposal that he's making to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and to all others who want to fight the new Jim Crow. Should be a very interesting segment. To open the show up, something that I've been really paying a lot of attention to, and you know, we've been talking about it a lot on the show with the hunger strikes that went on, you know, a little while ago, and the kinds of things that have been happening in the prison system in California. And, you know, just recently, the court ruled that they weren't going to delay or cancel the hearing, the case brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights against the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation and the barbaric system of solitary confinement at the Pelican Bay Secure Housing Unit, the Pelican Bay SHU. And this is just, I mean, it's just amazing what's been going on around there. And as in many of these cases, what comes out, even when you think you know a lot about what's going on in a place like Pelican Bay and what's going on throughout the state of California and frankly throughout the rest of the country, when you think you know a lot, a case like this comes along, and not only do you realize how important it is that there's places like the Center for Constitutional Rights and the attorneys and other people working there that are taking this up and fighting it out, but you also begin to realize how much has been kept hidden from even you. You, when you know, like for myself, when you spend a lot of time actually investigating this stuff. So I'm really pleased to welcome to the show today Jules Lobo. And he's the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he's a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Jules, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And you're also the person, are you the lead attorney on this suit against the California State?
I am.
Can you tell us let's first give people an overview of what the case is about, where it came from, what are the main issues that are being raised?
Well, it challenges the solitary confinement up in Pelican Bay, in which prisoners are living in a small cell, essentially 80 square feet, twice the size of the average American walk-in closet, with no windows. They never get any phone calls. Pelican Bay is one of the most isolated places in the United States. It's about 7 hours from San Francisco, 14 hours from L.A., where most of the prisoners are from, and therefore they get very few family or social visits. There's virtually no programming, no educational programs. They get recreation, but in another small area, which is theoretically outside, but it's got very, very high walls and a mesh grate that covers it, so you barely get any sun. And they stay in these cells 23 hours a day. Now, many people might say, well, how long could I survive in such a place? You know, 15 days, a month, maybe a year. We have almost 100 prisoners there who've been there over 20 years, and about 500 who've been there over 10 years. So these people are spending decades in these kind of conditions. The listener might also say, well, what do they do to get in there? They must have done something heinous in prison. They killed a prison guard Well, for most of my clients, they have never done anything in prison that's a serious infraction. You get put into this Pelican Bay solitary unit, which holds 1,000 prisoners, simply by having some association with or membership in a prison gang. The way that California determines who has association is you might have an artwork, like a Hispanic prisoner, and most of the prisoners there are Latinos, has an Aztec warrior with a spear pointed in a certain way, and California says, well, this is indicative that you're in some prison gang, and that's all you have had to have done. You don't have to show any behavior that's misconduct or that's antisocial, as long as you have some artwork or your name appears on a list or you write something that could be considered gang-related, you get put into this solitary unit for years and years and years. And for most of them, there's no way out. The only way out is to do what's known as debriefing, which is to become an informant for the state and not only forswear your allegiance to the gang, but also tell the prison authorities everything you know about the gang, and assuming, by the way, that any of these people know anything. And after 20 years, it's hard to imagine that even if they did know something, and even if they were members, they would know something much now. But so you have to become an informant, which puts you and your family at risk, and most of my clients are unwilling to do. Most of the people are unwilling to do. So they languish there with no hope of getting out and spend decades there. Probably many of them will spend, unless something happens, will spend their whole lives there. At least that's what they have to contemplate. So we brought a suit challenging this as cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment, and also as violation of the Due Process Clause, because the Supreme Court has held that you have to, in this kind of confinement, you have to give people periodic hearings which are meaningful. And these folks aren't getting any meaningful hearings at all. They're just essentially rubber stamped and kept in for every 6 years. They get some kind of review, but the review is essentially a rubber stamp. So our claim essentially is that this is torture, and it violates both the Constitution and the international law agreements prohibiting torture. It's cruel and unusual punishment, and it's a violation of due process to warehouse people like this for years without any meaningful hearings.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jules Lobel, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. You know, one thing, Jules, that really struck me is that how routine all of this is. I mean, here you are, you know, the dehumanization of the prisoners that are sent to the SHU, the dehumanization is just so damn routine. And it's even when you're talking about the fact that they can sit there and say, and I read, you know, various things that came out from the Center for Constitutional Rights and other things that talked about how, you know, when people are looking for medical care, when they're looking for, you know, psychological health care, you know, they're looking for different things, that, you know, something that are just bare necessities of staying alive, that they're routinely told, well, you know how to get better medical care to do exactly what you're saying, become a snitch, you know, get debriefed, you know. And this is the whole thing that's put there. And so a lot of these people, and it's really outstanding when you think about the kinds of the way that a lot of the prisoners, and I know a lot of prisoners have been very severely impacted by the many years in solitary, and you know, it's like, but the way that they've actually, one of the things that's inspired a lot of people, I think, around the world is the fact that these prisoners are also some of the prisoners who are involved in the lawsuit that you brought. Some of them are also people who have been involved, very, very heavily involved in the hunger strikes that basically echoed what was said in Attica back in the 1970s, that we are human and we demand to be treated as such, you know. And that, to me, is like really an essential point of all this.
I think our most basic claim is that this type of solitary for this amount of years is designed to and does strip people of their human dignity and their basic humanness, because a key element of being human is social interaction. We are inherently social beings. We want to talk to somebody else. We want to have some interaction. These folks have not had normal human interaction for 20 years, many of them. By normal human interaction, I mean they have the ability to everyone, you know, to talk by yelling through the walls to their next-door neighbor in the cell next to them, but they never see anybody's face. These cells are four walls. There are no windows. There are little holes where sometimes you might be able to catch a glimpse of somebody, but they're basically stripped of the social interaction and the environmental stimulation, which is a basic human need of all humans. But despite that, as you point out, many of my clients are people who have decided to resist this, and in that resistance, I think they've struggled to regain their humanness. In fact, they did a study of prisoners of war who were put in solitary. And as John McCain said, solitary is in a way the cruelest form of punishment because it attacks your spirit. But they found that the one way that these prisoners of war could prevent going totally crazy was to resist. And that's what these folks at Pelican Bay are doing, and they're planning. They've written a letter to Governor Brown saying that unless the California significantly changes what's going on up there, ends indeterminate solitary sentences where instead of just getting a sentence of 1 or 2 or 3 years, you get a sentence for your life, unless they do that, then they are planning on going back on hunger strike on July 8th. And I think the world and California hopefully will pay attention to them.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, as you were talking about this dehumanization, I was thinking even the exercise yard that they talk about, the exercise pen, is called a dog run. You know, and it's sort of, there's this whole thing that comes in around this that I remember reading, I can't remember, it was in something, either a press release that the CCR put out or something that said that, you know, that it quoted some of the prisoners, and one of them talking about feeling like he was silently screaming 24/7, and another one talking about how he was, his biggest worry is he had been in there so long that he was forgetting or he had forgotten what the touch of another human felt like, what a human touch felt like, what somebody else's skin touching your skin felt like. And you think about psychologically what happens to somebody in terms of this, what does make us human? What is required for, you know, for a human being to actually flourish as a human? And then I was thinking even this thing of, you know, I want people to know that to really contemplate this a little bit too, is that out of all the people that are in Pelican Bay, only 66 are actually in there for some kind of behavioral cause, some kind of, you know, misbehavior. That others are in there because of like assertions and innuendo, and even some, I would venture to think, some are also in there for some of their political ideals.
Many of the people are in there for their political beliefs. For example, one of my clients, a man by the name of Ron Dewberry, who has an African named Satawa, he's there primarily because he's written pamphlets and written histories of black nationalist struggles and movements, and because of that, they say he's a gang member. For many of the people, it's because of their political ideology and not because of any behavioral misconduct that the outside world would think would be really bad, like, you know, riots or violence or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think this is a form that California uses to control people and not really to prevent violence in the prisons. I don't think it's at work to prevent violence.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's really that's the fun. I think the function really is to you know, to repress people in this system.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jules Lobel, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Now, Jules, one of the things, too, that came up, and I just want to mention this so people know and they can check this out. In the middle of all this, the prisoners actually showing what, you know, coming off this thing about political ideals and beliefs, you know, in the middle of all this, something unprecedented has happened in relation to it. And that's the prisoners have actually issued a call for the unity of all the various nationalities inside the prison and outside the prison, and saying, look, when things start to get hot, step back and think a bit, and let's, you know, put things into a bigger cause. And I thought that was really important in terms of the way what you're talking about, in terms of these guys are, they are considered the worst of the worst. You know, that's what we're told all the time. They're the worst of the worst. And yet, and they're living in what, it's unimaginable. And you know, I was just watching Herman's House the other day, and Herman Wallace in Angola, and the man who spent the longest time in solitary confinement in the country. And you're looking at what actually the way that some of these prisoners are able to actually fight back and rise up above that is extremely inspiring. And I do think that the point of actually people standing in support and fighting in support of what the prisoners are doing is extremely important. And I wanted to ask you this. You know, there's a whole point that has come out in here where, in the lawsuit that you guys brought against the state of California, The state has come back and said, well, really, they were asking for it to be dismissed because they say that since the hunger strike, they've already set in motion all kinds of reforms, and there's processes being put into place right now that will actually answer all of the demands of the prisoner. What do you guys say to that?
Well, the prisoners say, and we agree, that the reforms are a sham, that they're cosmetic, designed to make people believe that they're actually doing something without real serious movement. For example, they claim that it's going to be a new behavioral-based system, but it still can be the case that you can get put in to the to solitary, to Pelican Bay, and you can be maintained there simply because of some association with a gang, as opposed to some specific misconduct. And as you pointed out, often people are put in there simply because some informant says, well, this guy is a member of the gang. Well, the informant, said that, and he's trying to get out. And he's saying whatever, we know that when people are under enormous pressure, psychological pressure to inform, they'll say many things and may or may not be true. And that's why people are there now. Now, you made one other point which I want to comment on, which is a very important thing has happened up there, which is that the 32 leaders of different ethnic groups, the Hispanics, whites, blacks, have put out a call throughout the California prisons, not only for unity, but to end ethnic and racial violence in California prisons. You would think that the California authorities looking at this, and I believe it's had an effect already on the California prisons, would say, well, this is a really good thing. We should encourage it. Instead, they introduced this document as evidence that these folks are gang leaders and have tremendous control over their subordinates. Namely, they're trying to urge everybody to end violence. Again, it's ironic that California looks at this statement, which I consider historic, as simply another form of gang activity.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jules Lobel, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. But I'll tell you, well, it goes along with what I wanted to ask you on this, and this will probably, I want to spend some time on this, and then this will probably be the last question, but I wanted people to get a sense of what goes on, and I want to compare and contrast here. A little while ago, during the hunger strike perhaps, or maybe a little bit after that, Terry Thornton, who I don't think she's any longer the prison spokeswoman, but she may be, but she was at the time. And she made a statement about when everybody's attention was focused on solitary confinement. And people should know, California is the only state that has indefinite solitary confinement, still uses it. It was thrown out, a century ago as too cruel, too barbaric, in a time where a lot was cruel and barbaric. And it was noted then, and California still, to this day, is the only state that actually practices and uses indefinite solitary confinement, meaning you can go in there when you're 22 and turn around, you're 72, and you're still sitting in a small little box. And she said, she had the audacity to say, is it really solitary confinement if you can take correspondence courses and watch something like 27 channels on your own TV? If I went to prison, I wouldn't want to share a cell with anybody. Now, you contrast that with what you said when you said that solitary confinement is beyond the pale for any civilized nation. Let's talk about that.
Right. Two things, and then I'll answer your question specifically. One is that I believe that this situation in Pelican Bay and in California is the domestic equivalent, in a way, to Guantanamo, because people are put into this situation indefinitely. They have no hope of getting out, and they haven't been charged with anything. They are simply there because they're believed to be, in this case, gang members in Guantanamo, terrorists. But there's no formal charges, and that's the same thing that we have here in California. The second thing is, I don't think it's quite accurate to say no other state practices indefinite solitary confinement. What California does, however, which is fairly unique, is it practices it on a wholesale variety. There are people like Herman Wallace who have been in indefinite solitary confinement for many years in other states, But California has thousands of them, and that's where California is unique in mm-hmm. the numbers and also in the draconian nature of the conditions. Now, in terms of this isn't really solitary. It's not really so bad. People can watch TV. People could take correspondence courses. It's true, people could watch TV. But if the listener imagines themselves sitting in a large closet with no windows 23 hours a day and going out to only something which is marginally different for 1 hour a day, for many, many years, I think if you really put yourself in that situation, you could see the terrible toll it must take on the human condition. Because to say that you can take a correspondence course or that you can watch TV doesn't go to the essence of our being, which is communicating with people. You can't communicate with a TV. Some people do talk at TVs, but the TV doesn't talk back. Now, you can communicate possibly with the guy in the other cell, but you never see him, and it's not normal communication to shout over walls. If this happens to you over years and years and years, it eventually crushes, or it's an attempt to crush what makes us human. And even these guys who are survivors here, and many of my clients are, they haven't gone crazy. They don't claim that they're crazy. In a way, then they're the survivors. But it's taken a terrible toll on them. And I think it's totally insensitive and a flight from reality for California officials to say, well, this really isn't solitary. They should try it for a little bit, and I'm sure they'd find it solitary.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure, actually, on that point, I think, in fact, it just bears out what you said, beyond the pale of any civilized nation. You know, this is, and frankly, somebody can make a comment like that. Boy. All right, Jules, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Sure, we'll talk to you again as things develop. Take care.
Okay.
All right, bye now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Jules Lobel, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. And we've been talking about the lawsuit that the Center for Constitutional Rights brought against the state of California around the solitary confinement at Pelican Bay and fighting against that and standing with the prisoners fighting against that. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network talking about a plan to stand up against the man. Okay, that's it. We'll be right back.
Exonerated Dupree, but it cost him his parents and his wife, his home, his life in the land of the free. Evidently, 5/5 an innocent man, but the court only saw 3. He spent 11,000 days locked away in the land of the free. The free, until we've unbound the praying hands of each innocent woman and man in these lands of
love. All right, Esperanza Spalding, the land of the free, all right? Couldn't ask for a more appropriate song for the theme of today's show. Joining us now is Carl Dix, founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he's here to talk with us about a proposal he made for action to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and all others who want to fight the new Jim Crow. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You begin your proposal, which people can access and study for themselves if after this and they're interested in getting in touch with you and adding their ideas in or talking about your ideas. They can get this at the site revcom.us. That's revcom.us. Now there, Carl, you talk about we face an emergency situation, and this is one of the things that led you to come up with this plan. Give us a brief understanding of what this emergency situation as you see it is.
Yeah, I mean, look, about 2.3 million people warehoused in prisons across the country, 60% of them black or Latino. And you were just talking about the situation of long-term solitary confinement. There are tens of thousands of people who are in solitary confinement in these prisons, and they're being held in conditions that are considered torture by the United Nations, just openly considered torture. This is not me exaggerating. Then on top of that, you got people who have served their sentences, paid their debt to society, but who are on parole or some other form of continued control by the departments of corrections, who are just openly stigmatized and discriminated against when they look for housing, when they look for employment, can't get government loans to go back to school, and denied the right to vote. Then on the front end of it, you've got racial profiling in the form of things like the New York Police Department Stop and Frisk plan, which just openly targets blacks and Latinos, especially the youth. And then you've got gang injunctions in other cities. You've got police being put into the schools in a way that now things where you used to be worried about being sent to the principal's office, where they send you is to the cop, and you can get arrested and end up down at the jailhouse for acting out at school. This is what we're up against, and there are literally, when you count the numbers of people, which number in the millions, and then the loved ones of those millions of people, you're talking about tens of millions of people whose lives are enmeshed in the criminal injustice system of this country. That's the emergency situation. It amounts to a slow genocide that's breaking bodies and crushing spirits. And it's got to be stopped. And stopping it is not going to be a question of persuading the authorities to change up. It's going to be a question of unleashing determined mass resistance. And that's what this proposal is aimed at.
Well, let's talk about this. Let's talk about some of the different aspects of that, because you say, as you say, you know, look, there's been I know you in particular and in other parts of the country, people have been doing some stuff for quite some time, whether it was around the support for the prison hunger strike out in California. There was other things that stop and frisk, all these things that were going on. And but you're calling for, so you're saying something bigger, something much more, you know, widespread and more intense is actually necessary. Can you talk about some of the key bones in that?
Yeah, I mean, some of the key focuses, you were just interviewing somebody about the situation in the California prisons with long-term solitary confinement. And thousands of prisoners there back in 2011 waged heroic resistance to that and actually forced the authorities to say they were going to do something about it, changes which they have not yet actually made and, in fact, have worked at ways of tightening up that situation. Those prisoners are talking about restarting. They've said they're going to restart this hunger strike on July the 8th. Now, here's what's really important. A lot of people do not know that this torture is going on. And they need to know about it, and they need to be challenged that they have to stand up and be against it. We can't allow people to get pulled by this thing of, well, we need to keep these prisoners down. You know, you don't understand. These people are prisoners. They're the worst of the worst, and they deserve what happens to them. No, they're human beings, and people need to stand with them. But there has to be a tremendous effort to both let people know about what's happening and change the way that people look at it so that they're looking at this as human beings being crushed by an illegitimate approach of the criminal injustice system as opposed to criminals who deserve what happens to them. We have to begin to work on this, and we have to begin to work on it now. I don't see it as let's wait until the hunger strike begins and begin to build support for it. We have to work now to let people know what's going on in these prisons. Let them know that not only are they torturing people in Guantanamo, the U.S. is torturing people in prisons throughout this country, and there are prisoners who are standing up against it, and we have to be with them. That's got to be the focus of a plan coming off of this proposal. But at the same time, Trayvon Martin's murderer, George Zimmerman, faces trial on June 10th. And, like, let's just be for real. The only reason he's facing trial is because there were outpourings of protest all across the country when they let him go after murdering Trayvon. And it's going to take continued outpourings of protest to have any shot at getting justice in this case. So, and then there are other fronts that we have to go at. You know, there are police are murdering people on a daily, weekly basis all across the country, and there has to be resistance, because without that, they get away with it almost every time. This proposal is aimed at forging plans that can allow us to take on the various fronts of this battle, do them in ways that can complement each other, as opposed to, well, we'll do one right now, and then when that's over, we'll do another. Now, how can we work on several different fronts? How can we continue the battle against stop and frisk here in New York City, but also take up the prison hunger strike all across the country and be in position to mobilize people around Trayvon? And then also, how can we begin to build the organization that's necessary to make that happen?
Well, before we get into the organization, Carl, before we get into the organization, I want to first, I have to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about a proposal he made for a plan of action coming up through the summer and into the fall to stand up against this new Jim Crow. Now, Carl, you were saying that get organized, and I think that's important, but there's a couple other aspects of this that I want people to know about. And one is that I do think that this point of you make a paragraph in your proposal is that the movement needs to take on a cultural expression. And I was thinking of that in terms of, look, there's a lot of people out there who are, you know, always talking about, I want to do this. I want to do this with my art. I want to do this with my music. I want to do this. And the point of this actually becoming, finding all the ways that this can have society-wide impact, that you can actually change the discourse over across the society and how important it is that the role that culture plays in trying to do that. Can we talk about that for a minute or so?
Oh, yeah, this is a very important part of it, because there's both the fact that there are people whose art is their life and who want to find ways that it can contribute to things but can't always come up with that on their own. We need to give them ways to get involved, ways to take this up, ways to be a part of doing this. And that can both be a part of the content of their art, but also in terms of being a part of reaching out to their audiences and involving their audience in something in a way that they can do that as part of a collective effort, again, as opposed to, well, they're on their own to try to do that and then talk about as being about nothing if they're not doing it. Well, let's, instead of trashing people for what they're not doing, let's give people a way to do it. We're looking at possibly organizing various forms of concerts, spoken word events, talking with actors about staging dramatic readings of letters from prisoners that both document the horrific reality that they're up against, but also document the way in which the prisoners are recapturing their humanity through standing up against it. Because some of the letters that come out of the prisons really show you the transformation that people are going through as they stand up to resist this injustice. And that's something that needs, again, to be known by many more people. And, you know, there's some actors and other people in the cultural arena who are like, yeah, we could do something with these letters. We could do it up in such a way that more people know about this. Reaching some musicians about doing concerts and things like that. So that's a part of it. And even down to the thing of, can we come up with a logo or an icon that could be on a button that, you know, expresses support for and involvement in this movement of resistance to mass incarceration and all of its consequences, that can become something that high school students are wearing as the school year winds down, and maybe even wearing at graduations. Things like that, which give people broadly a way to get involved, to be a part of this.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things I was just thinking about, all this also, one of the points that you make in your proposal is you say that sort of a, the last point, I think, is actually you make the point where you say that there, on October 22nd this year, there needs to be a commensurate response in the streets to the horror of what's been going on for the last, you know, decade or so, and especially over the last few years. The horror of all this, the massive, you know, the explosive growth of the prison population, people being railroaded in, the massive amounts of people being killed, and then the cops being all exonerated. And so you have a whole situation where it's literally you're living, it's, you know, you look on it, like you said, slow genocide that could very quickly move into a fast genocide, but you're calling for, or you've proposed, that people really pay attention to making October 22nd this year the 18th annual National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation, making that commensurate with the emergency situation we face.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I mean, because when we – I was a co-founder of the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality, and when we forged it, one of the things that we wanted to do was to bring in something that we called the criminalization of a generation, the way in which the youth were being targeted and being criminalized. And when you look at how things have developed since then, with the growth of the prison population, the expansion of racial profiling targeting the youth, it was like we were on to something that has escalated and mushroomed and continued. So that makes it a very important and timely day for action around this. And we want to work to bring this together and develop an arc that goes from now in the spring into the fall, so that that is a coming together of a lot of this resistance and calling on and bringing forth outpourings, and especially involving young people in this, because that's the generation that's really being targeted by this and needs to be a part of standing up and resisting it.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about a proposal he made for a plan of action coming up through the summer and into the fall to stand up against this new Jim Crow. And I should let people know, we have just a couple minutes left, but I want to let people know that one of those young people who has been really targeted by the police for standing up against the police and refusing to allow them to just brutalize whoever they want in any way they want while people are watching, actually standing up against that and being part of the demonstrations around stop and frisk, is Noche Diaz, who just recently, the charges in one of the major cases against him was dropped. They had to drop the charges. So that was a victory one victory. He's still facing many other charges. But I think it's important for people to know that
that kind of
thing is happening. I also want to ask you, and the last point is, you made the point about we need to get organized. People need to get organized. This movement needs to get organized. Let's talk about that. You have about 2 minutes to do that.
Okay. We're going to be pulling together a conference call very soon for people to begin to discuss this, a nationwide conference call, so that people in different areas can begin to look at this proposal, develop plans off of it, develop working groups coming out of it, and begin to work starting now to build up this resistance, focused around the hunger strike that's, you know, planned and being posed for the California prisons, but spreading this all across the country. And we really need and want people to be involved in it. And, I mean, you told people where they could find the proposal at the website www.revcom.us. If people want to find out more about the planning part of this, and especially to get involved, they need to contact the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. There's a phone number, an email address, and a website that I want to give. Let me start with the old school way. Phone number, 347-979-7646. That's 347-979-7646. The email address is stopmassincarceration@gmail.com. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, no punctuation, at gmail.com. And the website is www.stopmassincarceration.org. The situation is one of an emergency. Some of us are planning to begin to mobilize people and forge a response in terms of mass resistance that's commensurate to this emergency situation. And what we need is we need you. We need your audience and everybody that can be reached about this. Anybody who's got an ounce of justice in their heart needs to be a part of grappling with this proposal, enriching it, and making its vision and plan real.
All right, Carl, thank you very much. And for people, if you didn't get a chance to write that down real quick while Carl was talking, you can go to revcom.us.us, all right? So you can go there and you'll look for Carl's proposal there and you'll find out all the information about how to get in touch with him and with the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Mike.
All right, take care, man. Talk to you later. Bye. All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. You are listening to The Michael Slate Show. Don't stop listening now, but you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have been talking with Carl Dix, a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, about a plan for action, to stand up in a way that's commensurate with the horror that's going on in society today. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about another horror, and we'll be talking with the film director Angad Bala about his film Herman's House, which is a really powerful indictment of the solitary confinement and a really beautiful story about two friends standing up against it and asserting their humanity against the greatest of odds. So stay tuned.
I hear something saying,
well, don't you know?
That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain.
All right, chain gang from the one and only Sam Cooke. And I just thought that was, yet again, another really appropriate song for the theme of today's show. Well, and this is our last segment. You know, I'll just read a little introduction here to the subject we're going to talk about. Herman Wallace may be the longest-serving prisoner in solitary confinement in the United States. He spent more than 40 years living in a 6-by-9-foot cell in Louisiana. He was put in jail in 1967 for a robbery that he admits he did. He was subsequently sentenced to life for a killing that he vehemently denies, and many, many, many people believe that he has been framed. There's all kinds of evidence that he was framed, and part of that reason why he was framed, a lot of us believe, is because he was one of the founders of one of the earliest Black Panther Party chapters in prison, along with his the guy who's also in solitary, Albert Woodfox, and
the third member of the Angola Three, Robert King, who was released in 2001. He's the only released member of the Angola Three, and Robert has spent the better part of the last more than a decade in speaking out and building support for his comrades, Albert and Herman. And he's also been a fighter against the abuses of the criminal justice system, fighting against the mass incarceration and everything that's tied up with that. Now, today, both Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace remain in solitary at Angola Prison in Louisiana. Now, you think of Herman Wallace, it's really incredible what he's been going through over the last 40 years, more than 40 years.
One of the things, as I was researching, you know, some background material for this discussion, you know, you find out this thing that Angola, the prison, it's the largest maximum security prison in the country. It's 18,000 acres, and it's an old, abandoned slave plantation. And it's called Angola because that's the country where most of the slaves in that part of the country came from. Figure it out. What's the connection? Follow the lines and then decide what you got to do. And I'm really proud to welcome to the show a director of a really powerful film, a really beautiful film, Angad Bala, and the film is Herman's House. Angad, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's great to be on with you today.
Sure. Well, tell people about your film, what it is.
Sure. Herman's House, I mean, you gave a pretty good description, but Herman's House is about Herman Wallace, one of the Angola Three who's still incarcerated. He's still in solitary, where he's been since 1972, and was basically framed for his activism in the Black Panther Party at those times. But the film really explores this unique friendship he builds with this artist named Jackie Summel. And together, they work on this art project where Herman designs his dream home from within his cell. And the film kind of looks at their friendship and the evolution of that art project. It's kind of a way of letting people understand what's happening in prisons today, and really trying to reframe prisons and cells as living spaces, which I think we often forget that that's what they are fundamentally, are places where, you know, people, our fellow citizens, are housed. And so we tried to do that by telling this very specific story about Herman, and kind of also revealing some of the kind of immense brutality of solitary confinement in this country.
Well, one thing I have to ask right away is, how did you come to this story the way you came to it? How did you develop your approach to the film, to the story?
I mean, look, the pull would always be there. I'm going to go in and I'm just going to rip apart this. I'm going to do a doc on the situation of the, you know, solitary confinement and the situation in Angola, which is just horrifying, you know. But instead, you chose a certain angle that I think really did a couple of things. One, it really emphasized the humanity of Herman and Jackie, the artist, and it also developed the humanity while exposing the dehumanization, the constant dehumanization. There was a very sharp tension between humanity and dehumanization that runs throughout your film, and you handled it in a really great way.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, I think what you kind of described the reason I really went with this approach, but I mean, to answer your question, I came to the story through Jackie, through the artist. I mean, she was a friend of mine. We were both kind of politically active on campus at the same time, and she'd been working on this project, and I had kind of been hearing about it on and off. We had met in the 2002, actually, when we were all protesting against the impending Iraq war, and we see how that all played out. But at that time, that was what we were doing. And she, you know, I'd kind of heard about the project, and then in 2007, you know, her project was getting kind of more acclaim, and I was living in New York, and she came through New York and told me about this exhibit that they were trying to put out, and it happened in Germany, and they were going to try to bring it to the U.S. And you know, she explained what they were doing, and she shared with me kind of a small booklet of the letters between Herman and Jackie that, you know, had been edited down over the years of their correspondence. And I just thought, this is a beautiful kind of relationship story that could do exactly what you said. I mean, really, the goal of the film wasn't to get across, I mean, it does have a political message, but not some specific political platform, because I think the first thing that we do as a society when we put people through these horrific situations is we have to dehumanize them. I mean, there's no way we can acknowledge people's humanity and treat them like we do, whether they're undocumented immigrants and we call them illegal, or we call people who are in prison convicts or inmates. You know, then there's some other species, and that was the only effort I felt, is like, how do we humanize this one amazing person who's kind of represents kind of the extreme in terms of what we can do as a society to someone in the prison system. I mean, no one else has been treated like that. That was really the main goal. And I figured that, you know, once we did that, people can understand all the political context. They can go online, and there are other places they'll find that. But the film was, to me, just important to tell that story and really, you know, bring out Herman's humanity.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things that happens, it's really, to me, you know, you do this, and people should understand this, you do this with you, the only pictures, the only time you show Herman is you show him from years ago in a photo, and you don't, you know, there's a point that you realize that you've succeeded in doing, again, very subtly, in terms of, you know, bringing out what is it, how is this dehumanization carried out, and how is humanity asserted, you know, and when you, by not showing Herman's picture, by hearing his voice, a disembodied voice, by the one time that you get a chance to see a little bit of it and you get the sense of what it must be, and you get a full sense of what it means to be stuck in this solitary confinement like this, where the only way when somebody visits him, that he's you can only see a shadow of him, which was a very moving moment. I mean, here's this woman, Jackie, the artist, who's sitting there, and she's there to meet him. She wants to, you know, she wants to embrace him, even emotionally, if not physically. But she can only see Gray's shadow behind that and hear his voice. And to me, the way you did that really played a big part in emphasizing what it's all about.
That was kind of a conscious choice not to use photos of Herman, in part because that would make, firstly, we had so much footage of Herman, so much audio of Herman. It was all recorded phone calls of him. And we weren't going to be able to put a photo up every time he spoke, because that would have, we wouldn't have been able to sustain that for an 80-minute film. But the other thing was, that's the essence to me of the prison system and of solitary. It is about disappearing people. It is about making them not exist. So I wanted to really make the audience feel that. And it's funny because I thought, that might frustrate you as an audience member. And I thought, well, maybe that's good. Maybe, you should be frustrated. Hopefully you don't get frustrated at me, the filmmaker, for not putting a picture up. But you get frustrated at the system that disappears all sorts of, millions of people in our country, the prison system. And, 80,000 of those people are in solitary. So it was, it was, I think, a risky choice, and not every reviewer has agreed with it. But, I think for the people who do appreciate it, it really adds another level of impact.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners, you're tuned in to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Anged Bala about his film Herman's House, a powerful indictment of solitary confinement, and a really beautiful story about two friends standing up against it and asserting their humanity against it all. Now, Anged, one of the things that really, really struck me, too, was that, the idea, there's a couple of things. One is the fact that Jackie Simmel, the woman who's the artist who actually who developed this relationship and took this project on, and the way that the two of them worked together. And in a way, you could see the synergy developing that was, and as the relationship develops, you can see actually her commitment to actually finding the ways that she could both give people a sense of who Herman is and what he's forced to live in, and the idea that he can dream. Even the first question that she poses to him when she has her first conversation is, what does a man who's lived all of his life in a 6 by 9 foot cell for over 30 years dream of? That was an extremely important way to begin a relationship, I think. And then you see it how she, even in the art exhibit she develops, she has, part of it is a life-size scale of the prison that he's in. And it really horrifies you when you realize that's what it is.
Yeah, she's an amazing person, and I think, also a great artist. I feel like that part of my, she is totally committed to this, to Herman and to this issue. But part of what I really liked about her is she was continually, as artists do, trying to think outside of the box. And, there's no pun intended when we're talking about solitary. But she is, she realized that there's, what we have to do to get people to look at this, is also reveal that contrast between the beauty of his imagined home versus the kind of horror of his actual home. And so I tried to do that as much as possible in the film, too, where we continue to play with that contrast of the possibilities of what could happen if Herman was freed, if their project was realized, versus the reality of what was happening, which was throughout, unfortunately, a spoiler alert, he doesn't get out. He's still
right.
In
yeah.
solitary.
Yeah.
So that was to me, creating that tension was very important because it's the essence of her work and her efforts. And I think it does, as you said, they built this friendship over the years throughout that, and I feel Jackie's also unique in not, deifying Herman, which I think we can do when you meet people of that stature, members of the Black Panther Party who have suffered like he has. But he's still, he is a symbol, but he's also a human being, and that was also important that she was willing to have just an engaged, real human conversation as opposed to this kind of this activist worship that can happen in those types of situations.
Well, I thought one of the things that she said about the only way she could get him out of Angola was by, getting him involved in building his dream house. That was actually an extremely important point, I thought, in terms of capturing the spirit of the film and the spirit of what she's doing. Now, I have a real quick question because we're running out of time, but the film is it premiering on PBS soon?
It's it'll be broadcast nationally on PBS on POV, their documentary series, on Monday, July 8th. Mm-hmm. So it's not that soon, but it's enough time to mark your calendars and get out in advance. And it's playing right now in New York City, and we're hoping to bring it to other cities in the next 2 months leading up to the broadcast. So we are, you know, if you're out there and want to have it, check out our website, HermansHouseTheFilm.com, and you can sign up to bring the film there. And definitely also check out the website of the Angola 3 so you can get involved in how to free Herman, which is just angola3.org. So it's going to be broadcast on PBS, but we're hoping that to screen it in different cities around the country before then. And right now it's playing at Cinema Village in New York City, if you know people in New York City, or if you're listening to it on the web, you can check it out. It's playing all week there.
All right, Ange, we have to wrap it up now, but thank you very much for joining us today.
All right, thank you for having me.
All right, take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Ange Bala about his film, Herman's House. Don't miss it. And I also want to thank my other guests, Jules Lobel from the Center for Constitutional Rights and Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Committee. Well, once again, that brings us to the end of another show, but before we go, I got a couple more things to say. This is the season of May Day, and for everybody out there listening, think about that, May Day in the world today, all right? And when you're thinking about that, I want you to think about these quotes from Bob Avakian. Internationalism, the whole world comes first, and American lives are not more important than other people's lives. Two very short, very profound statements, things that really need to mark the spirit of May Day this year and all the time, and frankly, the spirit we all carry with us all the time. We're talking about the emancipation of all of humanity, not just one person here and there, one country here and there, but really standing with the people of the world. Particularly important given what's going on in the world today. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, but once again, not in a creepy way, do it through Facebook and Twitter, okay? We're going to go out now with a song that really rocked me when I was a kid and just gets better every time I listen to it in later years. And this is a cover by Black 47 of the old Buffalo Springfield song, For What It's Worth. Check this out. Talk to you again next week.
Exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.